This show is sponsored by BetterHelp. What would you like to get off your chest right now? Are you feeling lonely, unappreciated, or misunderstood? When you keep these feelings bottled up, they can affect you negatively. Therapy is a safe space to get things off your chest and work through whatever is weighing you down. It's a great way to increase your self-awareness, change negative thought patterns, and more. If you're thinking of starting therapy, give BetterHelp a try. It's entirely online and designed to be convenient, flexible, and suited to your schedule. Get it off your chest with BetterHelp. Visit betterhelp.com/beherenow today to get 10% off your first month. That's BetterHelp, HELP.com/beherenow.
Welcome to the Rerooted Podcast with Francesca Maxime, trauma-sensitive mindfulness meditation teacher and poet. Together, we'll take a closer look at approaches to transforming trauma with insights from psychology, neuroscience, spirituality, social justice, and the creative arts. Join Francesca and her guests for an exploration of our shared connection and how we can cultivate greater compassion for ourselves and for others. If you'd like to support Francesca and the Rerooted Podcast, please visit BeHereNowNetwork.com/Francesca.
For the first half of my conversation with Tada, please listen to episode 15 of Rerooted.
There's no one person pulling the lever, pulling the strings behind it. There is no one. Everybody's possessed in a way. We're essentially all possessed by the Matrix.
All in the same soup, you know, and we're all in the same, you know, different. It's one of my other mindfulness teachers, Gina Sharp, says, you know, bag of skin, you know, but we're all in the same soup. And, you know, what the difference that I hear you saying is, you know, we try to move away from things like good or bad, right or wrong, better or worse, into, you know, the language of mindfulness, which is, you know, skillful and unskillful, like the Buddha was teaching, like helpful or not helpful, right? You know, and so the wisdom in that, which is all about what the insight, you know, tradition is trying to reclaim the wisdom. The wisdom is the knowing itself, the equanimity, the balance, the way that, you know, it is when it's processing, right? We're in this process of becoming. We're not like becoming something, right? We're always like, you know, dying and, you know, being born and dying, like all the time, right? Mm-hmm. Collectively, individually, somatically, you know, whatever, cellularly, whatever it is. And that the rupture is the system that tries to impose something other than that emergence.
Yes.
And the healing comes from your intentional setting of the compass of the awareness of that system, you know, existing and sort of being a part of within, if you will, to use, you know, imperialist language that English is. And then being able to sort of drop into the place where, okay, given all of that, as again, Reverend Angel Keita Williams says, none of us are free until we're all free, meaning that we're in this as a collective. We're in this, like, your oppression is my oppression. My oppression is your oppression. Or the oppression is affecting us all, I guess is a better way to say it.
Absolutely.
In the framework that we're talking about. And even Carol Gilligan in the interview that I did with her, she talks about patriarchy. Why does patriarchy exist or persist? That's her new book. With one of her students, and she was talking about it as a defense against loss, a pre-defense against loss, right? So this Newtonian world, or this social security number world that Jack Kornfield, my mentor, you know, likes to talk about, is more along the lines of, I'm afraid to be hurt. I don't want to be vulnerable. Being intimate scares me, which is what? A trauma response.
Yeah, trauma is like very Newtonian. Like, it's used the word, and Newtonian matters because we live in it, right? And essentially, yeah, like, the work of, I think, healing justice, though, is about understanding the relationship, you know, like between like that Newtonian and quantum world and making sense of their connection and how they relate to each other, you know, like, and that's why embodied practice is so important. Relational practice is important. When we because in relationship, we can, you know, when we do relational embodied practice, we get to experience how the quantum shifts affect the Newtonian world.
Yeah. So give me an example of a relational embodied practice when we're not just spiritually bypassing into the quantum world, which some people...
Right. Well, I think, you know, like there's like a simple... I mean, the simplest example is like sitting across from somebody and just holding them in some kind of, you know, unconditional positive regard and noticing the changes in their body, right? That's like, so there's like a quantum shift that's happening that's perception-based, but then there's something Newtonian that shows up in the physiology, right? And the same that can be applied to, you know, social justice work is, you know, a lot of the changes that need to happen are mechanical changes in the system. But underneath that, we need something a lot more subtle
yeah.
to drive that. It's the subtle that drives the dense. That's like one of the principles of, right?
Yeah. So like the way I would say this again is when I'm working with clients as a somatic experiencing practitioner, it's sort of like the more regulated and sort of ability to, for me to just be present in my body and aware of what's going on in my body and to behold, share, connect, witness, have there be no barrier, if you will, between the space that we're in at that moment is part of what's healing in this relational embodied way.
Yeah.
I feel that.
Yeah. And it, when you talk, when you kind of graduate that to like a cultural somatic kind of understanding and watching the effects, like for example, like it's kind of how Western society talks about movements, you know, like for example, like you might say like the, you know, Black civil rights movement, there's these leaders and they did the work. That's like the white Western narrative is like there's these people that were leaders of organizations, they rounded up people and made this huge change. That's like the narrative that's sold, right? That's the story of Black liberation according to the History Channel or whatever, right? How we understand it.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm a dancer, you know, I'm a street dancer, so.
Yeah, you're great. Like, people got to go to your Instagram page.
No, don't do that. No, they can. Yeah, they can. But, you know, a lot of mine, like, social justice kind of orientation came from studying in those street dances, starting about 10, 15 years ago. So I started pretty late in my life. I'm 41 now, and so it was in my 30s or late 20s that I started exploring that. But so what people don't get, I mean, that's what I mean, the subtle informs the dense, is that like, okay, so when you're talking about the civil rights movement, our narrative often focuses on often even, let's say, like even name that, like men, even like powerful men in leadership positions, not all exclusively, but that's kind of where, you know, that's kind of where it centers. And not saying those people aren't heroic and important, and, you know, including like the trans and folks and the women, you know, who are also show leadership, you know, all those people being really important, not taking anything away from that. But what you start to see and understand is that like the when you're talking about bottom-up approach, right, and we do in somatic therapeutic work, you notice like what supports these movements is actually like parties, gatherings, like Soul Train, you know, like really, actually, like, right. Or actually Soul Train's like part post civil rights era, but you know what I mean? Like the, like, especially as a dancer, it's like the gathering of bodies of color, nonverbal communication, the spread of nonverbal language across the Americas, through, you know, an ancestral lineage being kept because of, you know, maintaining African, Afro-diasporic rhythms, movement styles, you know, like, and language alive and culture. Like, that's actually, when you actually look at what's happening underneath is that. And we, what we tend to remember is like these great acts that were, you know, undoubtedly amazing things. And, you know, people died because of these things, you know, like really important. But underneath that also, what sustains it is like, you know, because there's a culture of genius that's so, such a part of our white patriarchy that supports like this narrative. One heroic individual. Really, this person is an expression of this emergent phenomena that's been happening at a cultural somatic level all the way through. And that's what I mean in a cultural somatic approach to, you know, moving from the subtle to the dense. So I think a cultural somatic approach will look at like, okay, the great, like the hero will emerge. The hero will emerge as long as you don't stop partying. This is like the idea.
Right.
Does that make sense?
Yeah, no, I love that too, because, you know, again, that part of the whole fulcrum here is joy, is connection, is music, is dance, is all of the things that are nourishing, generative, life-enhancing, connective. You know, I think it's sort of what, to go back to the Buddha's language, you know, sangha, right? You know, spiritual friends, kalyanamitta, you know, whatever, that you're not in isolation. There's a whole fabric. Everyone's, you know, this thread, this current is, as you keep on saying, sort of operating, you know, undulating, you know, and eventually, you know, the thing, you know, gets kind of pushed out, up, right?
Yeah. That's what I mean. Like there's roots underneath, right? Like a network.
Yes.
And that's, and the cultural somatic approach would be like to understand that and actively cultivated that within an organism. So this is like, as opposed to inclusivity and accessibility through token.
Right. We're not just doing the barbecue because we have to like have a barbecue. We're doing the barbecue because we recognize and we have an awareness over the fact that this is an integral part of our overall connectivity.
Exactly.
Healing.
Yeah, exactly. And there's something about, like the way that a lot of organizations approach inclusivity and accessibility is like kind of like grafting things to places that have no nutrients. There's like no network underneath. So just like, you can't just like plant something where there's nothing been happening.
I love how you just said
that. Don't do that.
Grafting things to places where there are no nutrients. Exactly. Like I was recently introduced to a program that was meant to reduce gun violence in a Brooklyn community, in communities of color and youth violence. And it was like the wrong fit. The people who were doing it were, there was not a person of color there.
And
it had good intentions and a lot of money, but I was like, I don't really know if this is, you're grafting it to the place where there's nutrients. Like there's a misfit here, you know, missing.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think this is again like the kind of like boneheaded like thing about white supremacy culture is that I think, you know, this is like where I think I get really hot again is like where white people, white healing, white help needs to recognize is that like, you know, when you look at, you know, especially poor Black and Brown communities across the Americas, as well as, you know, like including, you know, as well, yeah, as like Indigenous communities as well. Like, it's like people have been doing this shit forever. Like, if you want to talk about reducing youth gun violence, Black and Brown youth, you know, within Black and Brown communities, right? Like, Black and Brown youth have been working on that for ages. Like, this is, I think this is like the kind of like misnomer, misthought, like, you know, for example, I think a really useful example is like crumping. So, you know, crumping is like a dance from, I think, the West Coast. You know, it takes after like shamanism and, you know, there's that group ritual and stuff, you know, when you actually look at the dance itself. And there's a social structure baked into crumping, right? Like if you are an elder, which means you might be like 25.
Yeah.
Right. Because this is, you're talking about family, you know, cultures where the adults have been incarcerated because of the crack. Like this is the war on drugs is the aftermath of that. Right. So you have like a person who's like, I don't know. I'm going to make up a name like the elder's name might be like, you know, Ghosty or something. That's their name. And so their disciples might take after their name and be a little ghosty, right? And what I understand about Crump is that it replaces a family structure that's been decimated by the war on drugs, so and the crack era. So you'd have like that person who's the elder who's really a young Black youth is responsible with other young Black youth to go to school, graduate. It's not just like a dance mentor, it's like a life thing. And so And crump groups are called houses, right? The house of da da da. So you actually see that there's all these generative social structures. So it's like, it's totally, to me, ridiculous, the idea that a white organization realizing there's this problematic thing that's happening in these communities and go in there with money and da da da. It's a waste of resources. It's really all about, like, in the end, attending to their own stuff when there's actually already, it's like, there's already regrowth, regeneration happening within these communities. They've been doing it forever. That's the only way they've survived. That's like all communities of color across the board, you know, like indigenous, black and brown, like Asian, Pacific Islander, you know, Latinx, like all across the board. That's what people have been doing for generations. And so there's a lot of cultural goods, cultural somatic work coming out of that. And again, it's like the kind of like, even with healing is like, no, like we have to reorient. It's like these like, young, you know, like poor people of color are actually like leaders. It's like totally opposite. It's like, you know, maybe they don't understand trauma, maybe they don't have the language, maybe they're working through things, of course they need assistance, but by and large, what the, you know, like a lot of the, I would tell you, like a lot of, you know, as a dance movement person, like, you know, I have some training, expressive arts and dance movement therapy, a lot of the stuff that like we do in like dance movement therapy class, like we do in street dancing. Definitely, like we do movement exercises and expansion exercises and stuff. That's like what that they do all the time. Yeah. So like even just it's kind of like a bananas idea to me that like we ignore the reality of these things happening on the ground. And I think a lot of, you know, again, inclusivity and accessibility, this is like has to start with some kind of humility and saying like, wait, it's not about like creating the space for people of color to receive the gifts of white people,
right,
which is really just like resources of their own culture through like a white lens, because
yeah,
I don't care if it's called somatic experiencing, it's still mindfulness practice that comes right from communities of color,
right?
Like it doesn't, like the neurological framing isn't
right,
like how we experience the mediums, right? Like we don't experience these dance mediums, for example, as like the neurological and scientific background is important and the structure is important, but there's also like ritual and somatic traditions that these come out of that are totally still alive, are recoverable, and a lot of people of color actually already understand them. They come in with like at least a broader understanding of those things. Like it's already baked into their culture, even if they don't like practice it. Like you know,
they are practicing it because they're living it. It's already woven in.
It
never went anywhere. It was already always necessary and a part of everything, you know, so it didn't have
to
be removed in order to be reimported, because it has always been part of what's kept the train going.
Yeah, like you don't have to explain to a lot of Black folks about vagal toning, because that spinal wave that, you know, like undulates and modulates the vagus nerve is a part of like Black diasporic dance. It's like everywhere. It's everywhere. Like it's in the lifestyle itself. And that's not the language that might be used, but that shape is everywhere. That's existing in martial arts too. It's like you don't. So I think there's something about reckoning with that, you know, reality. Yeah.
Yeah. And I love that. And we're going to need to start to wind down, but I do think that piece about, you know, a lot of people talk about evidence-based practice and they want things to be, you know, measurable. And how do you measure the quality of something in a quantitative way that is more intuitive, or that is more meant about something that is unseen, if you will, unseen, mm-hmm. depending on what eyes you're using to see. And I say eyes loosely, right? Yeah. I mean, it's a metaphor actually more than anything. As opposed to what your direct experience is, which is always, of course, that invitation in Vipassana practice, and is what is your direct experience around this in your body, in your soma? What are you noticing? And how does it shift when you're in community and with these practices? And you just mentioned ritual and crumping and all of that. You know, I really think that is the fundamental piece that a lot of communities, especially as Ruth King says, you know, when we're not, she's the Dharma teacher who wrote Mindful of Race, not the inability or the inawareness around like, let's naming claiming whiteness as a race, as opposed to just like as the water that we're in, you know, mm-hmm. that as we can begin to shift into this place of like, we need ritual. And in the white awake work, for example, you go back and even if you're of European descent and have white skin or light skin privilege, you're looking at what were those rituals, right? Mm-hmm. As opposed to just appropriating. And so that humility around that, I think, is really beautiful and important. Mm-hmm. And the wisdom is there.
Sure. It's really hard to find, but yeah, I'll be real.
In the communities you're talking about that are crumping and stuff, the wisdom is
there. Yeah, absolutely.
It's not named with evidence-based practice research studies necessarily, but it's there.
Oh, yeah. I think I meant towards more like for white folks doing ancestral healing work and trying to recover these ritual practices is a lot harder, frankly. Like, it is actually a lot. Like, and, you know, we're winding this down, but I think maybe it's helpful because, you know, you said, like, there may be mostly a white audience for this, so it might be interesting for white folks.
Well, I'm making that assumption, but...
Okay. sorry, world.
I said that. I'll own that. That was my...
Okay. Possibly. I mean, it wouldn't surprise me based on, like, my experience, right? I think there's something about going at, like... Yeah, and also regarding, like, of course, like, crumping and popping and house dance, they're not the pure ancestral authentic forms or anything. They're the forms for this generation, but they're also not dissociated from the reality of struggle and requirement of resilience, and that's what makes them authentic in this place now. And I think what happens in white culture is that, frankly, that, you know, it's understandable people want that to be the water as opposed to like an actual race, because that resiliency by and large doesn't exist within white culture. That's been like deleted. So there's a long history of that. Like, you know, when you look at like European culture, which is the ancestral culture of white culture, it's pretty void of somatics for a long time. Like, anything that is earthy, anything that is rooted embodiment-wise has been deleted for at least 600 years or something like that. You know, like, for example, I was talking to, there's a man named Michael Newton, who's a scholar on Gael culture, so Highland culture. And, you know, he talks about, you know, what people think of Scottish Highland dancing. And you know how, you know, a lot of folks practice Highland dance as a kind of like return to authenticity, right? The reality is, he said, like, what we know as Highland dancing is so impacted by the taste of the French court. So ballet is like, has so much influence over the posture of Highland dancing. We don't even know what Highland dance looks like what it was meant to look like from like the perspective of an indigenous Highland culture. There's absolutely no record. There's no way we can only, and it's interesting to realize that like there's no semblance. This kind of like really aristocratic embodiment style has been disseminated all across Europe, right? And that's the legacy that a lot of white folks live in. That's so that even when we try to go back, for a lot of white folks, there's nothing there. It's like, it's so far removed that, and so it's obvious that when you're coming from that place and have such poor cultural attachment base, we need to, I mean, when that happens, you know, like I did that, like I went towards like hip hop and culture to reintegrate myself. Like, you need another place where there's embodiment and resilience still somewhat intact, or like actually well intact even. And that's why a lot of people get pulled into cultures of color who are white, because, you know, I call it ancestral echoing. I don't think it's because people think, or maybe on some level they wish they were somebody else or something like that. But really what's happening is a desire to go back to the cultures that they came from or understand them. There's it's cultural attachment, like craving, that's trying to be fulfilled. And the Western therapeutic traditions are essentially representations of that craving and needing to go back to some kind of resource where ritual and embodiment, all that stuff made sense. And then that not existing within white culture, right? So needing to get to mindful practice, Afro-diasporic dance, like clown, like indigenous clowning, there's all kinds of stuff that is being resourced, right? And that's kind of, you know, the reality. And one of the things, you know, that's interesting that comes out of that is like, you know, when we're on this topic of Highland dance, it's kind of like a tangent almost, but interesting things happen. There's a style called buck dancing. I don't know if you ever heard of it. It's in the Appalachians. And what it is, it's a mixture, right? This is fascinating. It's a mixture of there's a lot of black folks in Appalachia, right? And so the people of the Appalachia are actually kind of like you describe yourself, like mixed actually, right? And so often some of them look white, but they're not actually purely white. I mean, you know, very few people are, but you know, that's a longer story. But yeah, they're like a mixture of like a different peoples actually. And there's a style of dance called buck dancing that comes from there. And buck dancing is a combination of Afro-diasporic dance and Highland dancing. And it looks totally different. The feeling looks more down. So there's like a thud as opposed to like this up energy. Mm. And it's thuddy and it has a more Afro tone. And it's interesting because, you know, what you call like an ancestral echo is happening possibly is that when you actually look at buck dancing, it might be more like what Highland dance used to look like.
Sure.
But it had to go through like an Afro frame to land back where it actually may have came from. We never know. But you might imagine that like you had this Highland dancing thing or jigging or, you know, like this more like, you know, kind of like, you know, Scottish, Irish type of dancing that needed to actually mix with Afro culture to reclaim something how it might look like. And yeah. So I think in terms of the psychotherapeutic world, I think that's kind of where we are. Like there's been a process and now for things to really be alive in this next stage for a lot of these healing traditions that have been stewarded in white spaces, there needs to be a lot more mixing. There needs to be a lot more opening up and there needs to be, you know, like a recognition that, you know, wisdom held, you know, away from the center of whiteness. And like that has a chance.
Yeah.
Like that has a chance of doing something. So I think that's kind of like where we are.
Beautiful. So
yeah, sure. That is a
fun. No, I think that's a rich, rich way to end. And I really, really appreciate that. And you know, I just want to name, you know, a couple things that we've used terms in this conversation that some people might not be familiar with. And I would invite them to Google them or use whatever search engine you might like. If it's something like Sis or Turtle Island or Crumping or any of that, I would invite you to just, you know, maybe take a moment if you've already spent this much time with us and then just kind of, you know, explore and see what happens, because you might then sort of get a bigger, richer feel for some of the things that we're talking about. And I just want to also invite Tida, before we leave, can you just share your website? I love the name. It's called The Selfish Activist. Tell me where that came from, if you can, and a little bit, and tell people how they can find you.
Yeah. Yeah, you can find me at selfishactivist.com. The name kind of originated from it being an oxymoron or a paradox, right? Of, you know, in Japanese somatics, there's a place called Hara. You might know it, you know, or the lower dantian. You know, it's in the belly, abdomen, pelvis. And it's considered the true seat of your being. So you are not your heart. You're not your mind. You are your hara, mostly, like 90% or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we're finding out that now that's like a neural network and the anchor of the parasympathetic nervous system. Who knew, right? So hara is a place of self. And it's actually intensely selfish. It's about your desires. It's about what you want to eat, you know, like it's about sex, like, you know, all the things that are just like really about your selfish desires. And one of the paradoxes that comes up in Japanese somatics and practices like Aikido is that, like, being rooted in your desire, it actually puts you in harmony with other beings. Like, being rooted well in your desire and your selfishness actually puts you in good relationship with other beings. And so is it kind of like a punkish kind of oxymoronic statement about how there's these two things that are considered separate, because a lot of activist people like suffer burnout and stuff,
right? Yeah.
And also a lot of it's about like giving something up yourself and self-sacrifice. And I'm kind of like, it's not really like that. There's like a whole different thing. So the word selfish activist to me like reflects that relationship to Hara. And it's really part of like my cultural identity too. It's kind of just like slipped in there. So yeah, that's kind of where it came from. And also like I had to shout out to, there's a friend of mine who I wasn't friends with them then. Their name is Emily Wapnick, and they had this TED talk about multi-potentialites. I don't know if you know. It's like a really, it's like what, you know, multi-potentialites, somebody has a lot of different interests in life. And they had a book called, I forgot, there's a book about how to name your business. And it was about like picking like words that had like this like kind of contradictory flair or something. And so I did their exercise, and that's kind of how it came together too. So that's the story. So shout out to Emily. They're a friend of mine now.
Great. Yeah. I like that. The selfish activists and getting in touch with our inner wisdom. Yeah. I mean, I love that, because your true Hara is your wisdom place, right? I would think. And, you know, I saw a little thing that said, don't mistake your gut instinct for your trauma. Right. Don't mistake your trauma for your gut instinct. Like, right. Like, we want to get with what our real true desire is, which is separate from like this craving or clinging or wanting more, 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 the insatiable piece of things, which is more like the ambivalent attachment you talk about, and really get back to like, hey, this is what my seat is in the midst of it all, my unique presencing in this Newtonian, you know, quantum world, and however way I manifest or we manifest. And yeah, and I got to get in touch with that. And then if we each do that, I guess in theory, we'll be more harmonious as a collective. And the work of cultural somatics is kind of a little bit of a map on how we get there. One of them anyway.
Yeah. It's definitely a map. And in my own practice, particularly because I have, you know, Asian somatic kind of ancestral lineage thing, it's most of it. Yeah. Most of it's in Hara. Yeah.
Yeah. Beautiful.
Yeah. Most of that. Mostly it's that. that's almost everything.
Well, it's a good place to be. We're going to leave it there and invite people to check out Selfish Activists. And thank you so much for being with us and sharing your wisdom and your embodiment on Rerooted.
Yeah, no, thank you for having me.
Take blessings. Good care. Yeah. Yes, blessings.
This show is sponsored by BetterHelp. What would you like to get off your chest right now? Are you feeling lonely, unappreciated, or misunderstood? When you keep these feelings bottled up, they can affect you negatively. Therapy is a safe space to get things off your chest and work through whatever is weighing you down. It's a great way to increase your self-awareness, change negative thought patterns, and more. If you're thinking of starting therapy, give BetterHelp a try. It's entirely online and designed to be convenient, flexible, and suited to your schedule. Get it off your chest with BetterHelp. Visit betterhelp.com/beherenow today to get 10% off your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.com/beherenow.